Chapter 8.
Piss. You're different, Hoffman,
Hopper said. He was a tall, lean, white-haired old eunuch who was training Dorian. Half-man, he reminded himself. Hopper handed him a pot.
What do you mean?
Half-man asked.
Two shits.
Hopper handed Half-Man two more chamber pots. Half-Man emptied half of the piss into each, swished it around, and emptied the pots into an enormous clay jar set in a wicker frame.
A piss for every two shits. The rest of the pisses go last. They're easy. You get a puke or a slippery, you use two pisses on those. No one wants to smell that all day.
Half-Man thought Hopper wasn't going to answer him. But after they finished emptying the pots into the enormous clay jars, six of them today, it meant one more trip for Half-Man than usual, Hopper paused.
I don't know. Look at how you sit all straight.
Cursing inwardly, Half-Man slouched.
He'd been forgetting.
32 years of sitting up straight like a king's son was dangerous. Of course, no one spent as much time with him as Hopper. But if the old eunuch had noticed, what would happen if Zurga, or an overseer, or a meister, or an ethling did? His half-Feyuri appearance had already isolated him. He was regularly singled out for extra chores and beatings for imagined infractions. The nights he didn't go to bed aching were rare.
Don't forget yourself. Puke. How the girls manage to nick wine is beyond me. If you do, well...
Hopper lifted his sandal-clad feet, one at a time, and wiggled his big toes. Those two toes were all he had left. He'd been caught teaching the bored women of the harem a dance, he said, and the only reason he'd been let off so easily was because Zurga liked him, and the dance hadn't involved touching or speaking to the women. Other eunuchs, Hopper said, were killed for less.
22 years since my little dance. 22 years I've been with the chamber pots, and I'll stay with them till I die. Now, help me with the empties. You remember the process?
One clean water rinses 10 pisses, or 4 shits.
Bright one, you. Help me rinse the first 40, then you can take the pots out.
They worked together, in silence. Half-Man had made no progress finding the woman who would be his wife. The Citadel had 2 separate harems, and several women were kept apart from either one. Half-Man had been assigned to the common harem. More than 100 of Garoth or Sul's wives and concubines lived here. Wives were the women who had produced sons. Concubines, those who had produced either daughters or nothing, which were considered equivalent. Given that Garoth or Sul had been near 60, all of the women were surprisingly young. No one ever said what happened to the old wives. It was strange to be in his father's harem. He was seeing a different and oddly personal side of the man who had shaped him in 100 ways. Like most Calidorans, the God King favored solid women with wide hips and full buttocks. There was a northern saying, "Vola ust vasur, vola us vosar." Literally, a man's horses and his bride's should be big enough to ride. Most of the common women were Calidoran, but the God King's harems included all nationalities, except the Feyuri. All of them were beautiful. All had large eyes and full lips, and he preferred taking them, Hopper said, as soon after their flowering as possible. Life in the harem, though, bore little relation to the stories Southrons told. If it was a life of luxury, It was also one of enforced boredom. Each day, as he gathered the chamber pots from the concubines' rooms, Half-Man stole glances at the women. The first thing he noticed was that they were always fully clothed. Not only was the God King out of the city, but winter was coming. With no possibility of being asked to serve any time soon, some of the women didn't even bother brushing their hair or changing out of their bedclothes, though there seemed to be a form of social censure that kept anyone from slipping too far.
"They used to sit there all winter, half naked, and made up like fertility whores, huddled around the fires and shivering like puppies in the snow," Hopper said. "Now we give him a signal when His Holiness is on his way. Just wait till you see it. You've never seen anyone move so fast. Or if one of them's called for by name, every last one of the others will descend on her. Kali's blood, you can't even see her for a good 5 minutes. Then, when she comes out of that circle, you'd swear they traded her for the goddess herself. Much as they hate each other and scheme and gossip, when the God King calls, they help each other. It's one thing to gossip and lie about a woman."
Hopper lowered his voice.
"But none of them wants to be the reason a girl gets sent to the Aethlings."
Dorian's stomach turned.
So they knew. Of course they knew.
Dorian's seed class had been taught flaying on a disrespectful concubine. Dorian, as the first of the class, had been assigned her face. He remembered his pride as he had presented it to his tutor, Nef Dada, whole. Even the eyelids and eyelashes intact. The 10-year-old Dorian had worn that face to dinner as a mask, making japes with his seed class while Nef smiled encouragement. God help him. He had done even worse things.
What was he doing here? This place was sick. How could a people tolerate this? How could they worship a goddess that delighted in suffering?
Dorian sometimes believed that countries had the kind of leaders they deserved. What did that say about Kalador, with its tribalism and endemic corruption held in check only by its deep fear of the men who styled themselves god-kings? What did it say about Dorian? This was his people, his country, his culture, and once, his birthright. He, Dorian or Sul, had survived. He'd demolished his seed class, one at a time, pitting brother against brother until only he survived. He'd accomplished his Urdtan, his harrowing, and shown himself worthy to be called the God King's son and heir. This, all of this, could have been his, and he didn't miss it for a second. He loved many things about Kalador. The music, the dances, the hospitality of its poor, its men who laughed and cried freely, and its women who would wail and keen over their dead, where Sothrans stood silent like they didn't care. Dorian loved their zoomorphic art, the wild woad tattoos of the lowland tribes, the cool, blue-eyed maidens with their milk-white skin and fierce tempers. He loved 100 things about his people. But sometimes, he wondered if the world wouldn't be a better place if the sea swept in and drowned them all. As sacrifices for abundant livestock, how many of those blue-eyed girls had laid their mewling firstborn sons on Kali pyres? For abundant crops, how many of those expressive men had caged their aged fathers in wicker coffins and watched them drown slowly in bogs? They wept as they did murder. But they did it. For honor, when a man died, if his wife wasn't claimed by the clan chief, she was expected to throw herself on her husband's pyre. Dorian had seen a girl 14 years old whose courage failed her. She'd been married less than a month to an old man she'd never met before her wedding. Her father beat her bloody and threw her on the pyre himself, cursing her for embarrassing him.
"Hey!" Hopper said. "You're thinking. Don't. It's no good here. You work hard, you don't have to think. Got it?"
Half-Man nodded.
"Then let's strap this on and you can work."
Together, they strapped the wicker basket to Half-Man's back. There were thongs that wrapped around each shoulder and his hips to help him bear the great weight of the clay pot full of sewage. Hopper promised to have another pot ready by the time Half-Man got back. Half-Man trudged through the cold basalt hallways. It was always dark in the slaves' passages, with only enough torches burning so the slaves could avoid colliding. "I'm tired of banging toothless slaves," a voice said around the next intersection of hallways. "I hear the new girls in the Tiger Tower. They say she's beautiful."
"Tavi, you can't call it that."
Berthold Ursul was Dorian's great-grandfather, and the man had gone mad, believing he could ascend to heaven if he built a tower high enough and decorated it solely with Harani's sword-toothed tigers. His madness embarrassed Gareth Ursul, so he'd forbidden the tower to be called anything but Berthold's Tower. Dorian stopped. There was a torch at the intersection, and no way he could retreat without being noticed. The Ethlings, for no one else spoke with such arrogance, were coming toward him. There was no escape. Then he remembered. He was Half-Man now, a eunuch slave. So he slouched and prayed that he was invisible.
"I talk how I please," Tavi said, coming into the intersection just as Half-Man did.
Half-Man stopped, stepped aside, and averted his eyes. Tavi was a classic Ethling, good-looking if with a hawkish nose, well-groomed, well-dressed, an aura of command, and the stench of great power, despite being barely 15 years old. Half-Man couldn't help but size him up instantly. This one would be the first of his seed class. This would have been one Dorian would have tried to kill instantly. Too arrogant, though. Tavi was the kind who needed to brag. He would never make it through his Urdtan. "And I can fuck who I please, too," Tavi said, coming to a stop. He looked down each of the halls, as if lost. His indecision froze Half-Man in place. He couldn't move without possibly moving into the Ethling's path.
"Besides," Tavi said, "the harems are too closely guarded. But the Tiger Tower's just got two dreads at the bottom and her deaf-mute eunuchs."
"He'll kill you,"
the other Ethling said. He didn't look pleased to be having this conversation in front of Half-Man.
"Who's gonna tell him, the girl? So we'll kill her, too. Fuck, where are we? We've been walking this way for 10 minutes. All these halls look the same."
"I said we should have gone the other..."
The other Ethling began.
"Shut up, Rivik."
"You,"
Tavi said, speaking to Half-Man. Half-Man flinched as a slave would.
"Kali, you stink.
Which way is it to the kitchens?"
Half-Man reluctantly pointed back the way the Ethlings had come. Rivik laughed. Tavi cursed.
"How far?"
Tavi asked. Half-Man would have found some other way to answer, but Dorian couldn't help himself.
"About 10 minutes.
Rivik laughed again, louder. Tavi backhanded Dorian.
"What's your name, Half-Man?"
"Milord, this slave is called Half-Man."
"Woohoo!"
Rivik hooted.
We got a live one here.
Not for long, Tavi said.
If you kill him, I'll tell,
Rivik said.
You'll tell?
The disdain and disbelief on Tavi's face told Halfman that Rivik's days as a sidekick were numbered.
He made me laugh, Rivik said. Come on, we're already late for lecture. You know how Drafe will try to turn that on us.
Fine, just a second. The veer rose to Tavi's skin, and he began chanting.
Tavi!
It won't kill him. The magic was a slight concussion, inches from Halfman's chest. It threw him back into the wall like a rag doll. The wicker splintered, and the clay pot shattered, geysering human waste over Halfman and the wall behind him. Rivik laughed louder.
We've got to remember this next time we're bored. Kali's tit, it reeks. Imagine if we could break one of those pots in Drafe's room.
The Ethlings had left Halfman gasping on the floor, wiping ooze from his face. It was 5 minutes before he stood up, but when he did, it was with alacrity. In the fear, and in the miming of fear, he had almost missed it. The newest concubine could only be one woman. His future wife was at the top of Bertold's tower, and she was in danger